we'll discuss tax deals and state employee contracts and other news of the week in this edition of The Week in Review. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. You're tuned to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is 8 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Friday, December the 17th. As we do every Friday at this time, we have two guests from different viewpoints to discuss and debate the issues in the news this week, including the House of Representatives approving last night the tax cut compromise bill that President Obama worked out with Senate Republicans. The president is said to be ready to sign that bill today. And we will talk about the feud that is developing now between state labor unions and the outgoing Senate Majority Leader, Russ Decker, who had changed his mind on approving state labor contracts on Wednesday. He reversed course and voted against union contracts for some 39,000 state employees, which led to a very, very sharp reaction from the head of the state employees union, Marty Beal.
My only comment is that Russ Decker's a whore. There's absolutely no question that he had ulterior motives as he cast his vote.
1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk at WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page if you would like to talk about these issues or would like to bring up an issue for our Week in Review discussion. Let me welcome our guests. We are happy to have with us Tom Still, president of the Wisconsin Technology Council, former associate editor of the Wisconsin State Journal. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Joy.
Also with us, Bill Leaders, who is news editor for Isthmus Newspaper. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning. You have to plug my book, too.
Author of
the new book, Watchdog.
I bet you would make a great holiday present.
It would be. It would for everybody on your holiday list.
I have an old book you could plug.
What is that? I forgot the name of that one.
Hands-on environmentalism.
That's right. So we got a couple of authors here, too. I'm sure that you can look them up on the web. I want to start with Marty Beal and that comment we just heard. That's pretty strong language. Why did Russ Decker change his mind, Bill Leaders? Do we know?
I don't think we know exactly. I wouldn't completely rule out that he was somewhat honest in the representations he made as far as what motivated him, that he felt it was late in the process, that the voters had spoken, they wanted a new administration. The governor did not get around to advancing this until after the elections. He had 18 months, and the Democrats had 18 months to move this along sooner, and they didn't get off the dime on that, and now it just seemed like they were trying to ram it through, and he had problems with that on a procedural level. I will say, as far as Marty Beal's comment, that in my opinion, Marty Beal is an ass. And as he spelled out the word whore when he called that of Russ Decker, I'll spell it out. He is an ASS. The state employees of the state of Wisconsin are ill-served by that kind of rhetoric. And I think they're ill-served by Marty Beal.
Woo! I didn't expect that, Bill. A reaction to that, Tom, or to the to what happened this week in the state legislature with the state employee contracts.
Well, I'm probably not going to spell anything here, but I think, you know, no matter what Senator Decker's motives may have been on this, I think part of what Bill says may well be true. Just process that. There had been a number of things that perhaps in both houses over time and the relationship with the current administration, perhaps they thought had been rammed through in more than one occasion in the past. One thing's pretty clear, though. It was an early Christmas president for Governor-elect Walker who had been obviously saying that those contracts should be held up, that he wanted more time to investigate what he thought were, I think, and some people have said, were time bombs in the contracts, and so that's now probably going to happen.
Yeah, and is that a raw deal for state employees, Bill, do you think?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, make no mistake, state employees got the shaft here. State employees were betrayed But they weren't just betrayed by Russ Tucker. They were betrayed by the governor and the Democrats, who did not pass these packages until they tried to ram it through at the last minute. And clearly, the Republicans have succeeded in demonizing state workers to make them the brunt of the problem and to focus popular resentment on them. The cover story in Isthmus this week is on precisely that topic, how unions and state workers have gone from being something that have been respected in Wisconsin to something that are now being reviled and demonized and seen as the source of our problems. And we're supposed to think that it's a huge problem for the state that state workers have reasonably good jobs and benefits. We have to somehow stop that, you know, and make their jobs just as crummy as the crummiest jobs that you can find in the private sector. All of that is terribly unfair to the public employees of the state of Wisconsin.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the things that's worth saying, and this is about, you know, state employees, sort of regardless of whether they're unionized or not, as we move ahead, I think it'll be important to remember, for both Republicans and Democrats, that the budget won't be balanced on the back of state employees. There simply isn't enough money there when you do the math. Five areas of state government that really represent 80% plus of all spending: local school aids, aids to cities and counties, Medicaid, the UW, corrections. That's where most of the money is. Mm-hmm. The rest of state government is, you know, kind of a 20%. So it's worth remembering as people move ahead that the focus will have to remain on some of the really big programs.
Yeah. That being said, though, Tom, do you think that we're going to see more than 8 furlough days per year for state employees, more money being contributed to pensions and health care benefits and the like?
I don't know. I'm personally not a fan, as you look at it from a management point of view, of furlough days, because they kind of fall sort of haphazardly in terms of where the needs may be. I think as you look ahead, there may be more across the board controls on wages over some kind of a term. There may be a stronger look at the benefit side of things, because when you do look at a couple of metrics about state employees in general, they're versus the private sector, they're paid about the same, to get right down to it. And there are actually fewer state employees per capita than you might see in some places, but the benefit package is high. It's something that you don't see pretty much anywhere in the private sector. So it you know, that's why, well, as these contracts are back on the table, that you might see some different approaches.
Bill? The contracts that were negotiated belatedly did contain more than $100 million of concessions from state employees to the state in recognition of the state's heart, including, you know, continued furlough days, as you said, eight furlough days per year, increased cost of to the state employee for pension plan, health care, things like that. There were significant concessions that were made. There were salary caps that were accepted. I don't know that the state employees really need to give more. I think that they've shown that they're willing to negotiate in good faith. I don't think that the state of Wisconsin, though, has shown that it is willing to negotiate in good faith with its employees.
Let's talk just briefly, as we wrap this one up, talked a little bit there about the future of the state employee contracts. What about the future of Russ Decker? There is no...
What future?
There's speculation, there has been at least rumors, and I'd like you both to react to it, that somehow Russ Decker might have a deal with Governor-elect Walker to have a job in his administration. Do you see that happening? Do you think that rumor is true, Bill?
It's hard to know. I think it would be kind of shocking if that were to happen, and I think the blowback from it probably would be so great that as to preclude it practically. There's other rumors as to his motivation, that he wanted Chuckwalla to get a pardon, and the governor refused to do that, and this is payback for that. Certainly there was no love lost between Russ Decker and Jim Doyle. It might be as simple as, wanting to stick it in Doyle's eye at the end of his service, having been retired by the voters. He wanted to go out with a statement to Doyle. There are all kinds of speculation, and I do think it's correct for people to feel resentment toward Decker for what he did and how he did it. But I would say that he is not the only problem here. The Democrats share some of the blame. Certainly the Republicans share some of the blame. And certainly the people of the state of Wisconsin have been persuaded that somehow we need to kick state workers around a bit. We need to take them down a few notches. We need to hurt them, make them hurt like everybody else. And I think that's just terribly unfair to our public service servants.
Plenty of blame to go around, Tom Steele.
Well, let's talk first a little bit about this Governor-elect Walker job for Russ Decker scenario. I would agree with Bill wholeheartedly. I just don't see that happening. It's not the kind of thing that Scott Walker would tend to do by in terms of ideology or his outlook on things or anything else. So I would be very short of amazed if that were to happen. In terms of blame going around, you know, one thing to think about here with Russ Decker, he was a bricklayer by trade. And when you look at some of the private trade unions in Wisconsin, they are among those who feel, I believe, that they have felt the brunt of some of what's gone on in the economy. I don't know what percentage of bricklayers would be out of work right now in this down economy, but I have to believe it's significant. And so there may be something of a schism between the trade employee unions and the public employee unions as you look at the different trends of what have gone on in those two sectors. So that may be a factor.
Wow, that's harsh. That's, you know, even other employee unions hate state employee unions.
That's not fun, yeah. we're going to take a short pause, and then we're going to move on to the national story of the week. Well, what I think must be the national story of the week in politics. We have a bill on President Obama's desk that will extend tax cuts, the Bush-era tax cuts, for all, including the wealthy. Extends unemployment benefits and some other things, too. We'll get our two guests to react to that coming up. And we welcome your reaction, too, at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Talking with Bill Leaders and Tom Steele, and I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Week in Review on the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine, hoping you'll stay tuned. Coming up after 4 this afternoon, it's your views on the news. You can call in and talk with Ben Marins and his guest about what you think is the most significant news story of the week. That's tonight, or I should say this afternoon after 4 here on the Ideas Network. Tonight at 7:30 on Wisconsin Public Television, an interview with outgoing Governor Jim Doyle. That's tonight at 7:30 on Wisconsin Public Television. We will on Monday morning after 7 o'clock in our state capitol report, talk more about the state employee union contracts and what happened this week in the special session of the legislature. So more on that issue coming up in our state capitol report after 7 o'clock on Monday morning. I'm Joy Cardine talking with Tom Steele, who is the president of the Wisconsin Technology Council, former associate editor of the Wisconsin State Journal, and the author of the book Hands-On Environmentalism. And also Bill Leaders is with us, news editor for Isthmus Newspaper and the author of Watchdog, 25 Years of Muckraking and Rabble-Rousing. Available for your holiday gift giving.
Uh-huh.
let's talk about what's on President Obama's desk as we speak. The House of Representatives, it says here, reluctantly approved this tax deal, 277 to 148. This extends the Bush-era tax cuts to everyone, including those who make more than $250,000 a year. It extends unemployment benefits. It cuts payroll taxes for Social Security and some other stuff. Your reaction, Bill Leaders, was this a good thing or a bad thing?
I don't think that you can break it down as one or the other. It was a compromise agreement. I don't think there was any question once it was negotiated between the president and the Republicans, who are about to control everything, that if they don't already, that it was going to pass, and it was going to pass overwhelmingly, which it did. The Democrats and Obama did get some things that they wanted. The Republicans certainly got what they wanted, which was continued tax cuts for the super rich, even though it will dramatically drive up the deficit. I think one of the conclusions we have to draw from this is that neither the president nor the Republicans nor the Democrats are the least bit interested in curbing the deficit. They're totally fine with driving the deficit to astounding new heights and embracing policies that will do that. And, you know, they may find some value in decrying the deficit when it's to their advantage in trying to get elected. But when push comes to shove, they're all for driving it into the stratosphere.
Is that what's going to happen, Tom Still?
Well, I think on balance it is a good thing because these tax cuts and the uncertainty about what was going to happen was driving so many economic decisions and the decisions that in particular I think small business owners, as they looked ahead to 2011 and the kinds of things that they were going to do, hire or not hire, strategic partnerships with other firms or no strategic partnerships, all those kinds of things were sort of hanging fire over what was going to happen. Now, that said, and again, I think tax cuts, you look at the history of this, we've always seen a burst of economic activity after tax cuts. People will say, well, it's going to reduce the revenue. What happens is you have more economic activity and you create more revenue. That said, the big mistake in the past with some tax cut bills has been followed by a flurry of federal spending. This gets to Bill's point about the deficit, that unless there are efforts to control on the spending side as Congress and the president move ahead, I think that's a problem, with especially in terms of how our deficit is viewed around the world. And probably, you know, I'd have to say that, you know, in terms of President Obama, it's probably a victory for him because he compromised and worked with all sides on this in a way that perhaps he's, that was some of the, I know on the left there were complaints that he compromised too much. I think for a lot of Americans in the middle, you see, I think they wanted to see this.
Overall, is this a victory for President Obama, Bill Leaders?
Well, he did get a deal and he did get some of what he wanted. He also incurred the wrath of his party and he proved that he was willing to abandon principle, that he will say things to get elected about how he will definitely fight against the extension of the Bush-era tax cuts for the super rich. He'll not accept that. He considers that to be disastrous to the country, all reasonably so. And yet he'll agree to continue those into an era of Republican leadership, which probably means for the rest of time, regardless of the catastrophic consequences to the deficit. I agree that this package probably will help the economy, but if economists know anything, and I think they do, we can conclude from what they've told us that the lower level provisions, that is extending the unemployment coverage for people who are about to lose it and have no money at all to spend, and extending the tax cuts for the lower and middle class, will have a far greater consequence in terms of boosting the economy than extending them for the super rich. And extending them for the super rich counts for like $700 billion of the $900 billion tax cut. So most of that money is just going to go to make the super rich even more super duper rich.
Let's think about what defines super rich. In a lot of places in this country and in the Midwest, unfortunately, we'll see that per capita wages are lower. $250,000 in the super rich. I mean, that's oftentimes, those are small business owners who, that may be a figure that's going to reflect a lot of things about their income and how it's derived. And those are the folks who are going to reinvest in this economy. That money will go back to work. And the tax cuts obviously are going to help in terms of the other income strata throughout this. But that's the group that's going to put that money back to work in ways that I think will ultimately be productive.
We have callers, so let me go to Gary in Merrill. Hi, Gary.
Yes, hello. Well, I love the country, but increasingly we have to be just disgusted with ourselves. This tax deal is just another way for Americans to avoid responsibility to their country and to the value of their dollar. We've had this tax cut deal. It's just extending it. I don't see jobs from it. $250 billion a month trade deficit. We could start an import tax. That would really change the tables and let China be on the defensive with the trade, but it's not going to happen because the politicians support the multinational corporations and the people come second. Thanks.
All right. Bill Leaders, do you have a reaction to that?
I think there's probably also some of the trade agreements would make putting the import tax either impossible or problematic. But I agree with the caller that it does represent an abdication of our responsibility to our country and especially to its future. I think what's needed is for us to pay more taxes. It's obvious. It's been obvious for some time that we cannot continue to cut taxes as they're our only instrument for reviving the economy to allow people who make millions of dollars a year to get even richer and to vastly increase the disparity between the super rich in the country and the super poor, which has been happening pretty consistently over the last several decades. We can't continue to do that and not bankrupt our country. And we do not have the political leadership or the political will or, frankly, the spirit of self-sacrifice on the part of the American people to make that happen.
Tom Stoll?
Well, I think it's important to remember that this bill will extend the tax rates that were in place, and it doesn't necessarily mean tax revenue is cut. In fact, I think by lifting the uncertainty around this, we will see a burst of economic activity and we'll see more revenue.
Are we going to just have the same debate, or will it be different because there's a new Congress 2 years from now? It extends these for 2 years, and so in 2012, are we at starting all over?
Oh, I think Bill will agree with this. I mean, absolutely. It's going to be central to the 2012 presidential and congressional elections. It will be one of those foundational kinds of debates about how we conduct government, how we try to steer the economy. So I think absolutely that'll be the case.
It will be, but it will be presented in the same way it was presented this time, is that the Democrats want to raise your taxes, the Republicans won't. And what the Republicans really want is to preserve these tax cuts for people who don't need them. And they will use the argument that your taxes are going to go up as an ordinary person unless you vote for them. And, you know, it may be persuasive. They may continue to keep the deficit at these sky-high levels and continue to keep taxes for the rich low enough that we don't have enough money to pay for the things that that we're buying.
Let me ask you both just a quick reaction to this poll out this week. The new poll says 13% of us say we approve of the way Congress is handling its job. The 83% disapproval rating is the worst Gallup has measured in more than 30 years of tracking congressional job performance.
Go Congress. No, really, go.
We've always said Congress as a whole is doing a bad job, but maybe our individual congressman or woman is doing an okay job. But that's the worst in history, Tom Stoll. Why do you think that is?
Oh, I think there's a lot of pent up frustration and in those poll results. You know, the new Congress has obviously yet to be sworn into office. This is, I think, a reflection of the performance of the past Congress and also this interim period where there's sort of this, you know, no man's land of what's going on right now. And so in some ways it doesn't surprise me because, you know, a lot more public disapproval, it seems, over time has tended to settle around the performance of Congress than the performance of any individual president. Yeah, I think that gap is always there historically between mm-hmm. president's ratings and then congressional ratings.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about...
Just identify what I think is one key factor for the public's low opinion of Congress. It has to do with the members of Congress and the candidates for Congress. And I don't mean the things that they do or don't do. I mean the things that they say about each other to get elected. The demonization of politicians has been led by politicians who get elected by claiming that the other guy is a crook, that the system is broken, that we need to have some vast, sweeping, radical reform in order to survive as a country. All of the buttons are being pushed to make Congress seem like the worst possible institution on the face of the planet. And frankly, our voters, to some extent, have bought it. They've accepted what politicians say about themselves, which is that they're a bunch of crooks and jerks.
The politicians are saying... That earmarks are bad, but yet there are a lot of earmarks in a bill that would provide more than $1 trillion to keep the government running. So we're gonna pass a government spending bill that's full of earmarks. Tom Still, what's going on with that?
Well, there's some interesting pro-con arguments about earmarks. One, of course, is that earmarks represent 1/3 of 1% of total federal spending, but yet they're this visible tip of the iceberg that people react to. Over time, I think a lot of members of Congress have said, "Look, it's the president and the executive branch that gets to propose budgets, and then the agencies carry them out, and Congress is here more or less asked to rubber stamp things. Why shouldn't we have a few things that we try to get into the budget?" But what has happened, of course, is some of these things wind up making little or no sense and when you look at some of the individual earmarks, and those are the ones that are often signaled singled out. So it's a bit of a mixed bag, but I think under the current system, with unless there are some reforms, this was probably going to be inevitably part of this deal.
One of the earmarks in this bill, $400,000 to Iowa to commemorate the 1959 visit of Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev, and that this would be used for a trail for bikers and hikers.
See, I think that is that's a perfect example to focus on. Earmarks are demonized because politicians refuse to be honest with the American people about how our money is really spent and why we have huge federal spending. There's all kinds of money that's going to all kinds of things, and they pick on these little items and try to make that the problem. This $400,000 in Iowa, which you said would commemorate the visit of Khrushchev, is going to build a bike and hike trail.
Right.
Look in Wisconsin, what the bike and hike trails, the Sparta Elroy Trail, the Glacial Drumlin Trail, the 500-mile trail, that trail up north that goes through Hazelhurst. These are assets to the communities that they're in. They aid the economy. They're value added. This is fair compared to spending money on a battleship that the Navy doesn't even want, or adding an extra $400,000 to the bonus of a Halliburton executive for a job well done. This is a fairly responsible use of federal dollars. And yet this is what the politicians like to point to and say, we got to stop this. This is what we got to stop. Mm-hmm. Yeah, don't worry about the $1 trillion in defense spending or our foolish and unnecessary wars and all of the money that is being thrown into those rat holes, or the tax breaks that we give to multi-millionaires and billionaires. Don't worry about that. Let's stop this bike path.
How about the New START Treaty? Should the Senate ratify the New START Treaty, Tom Still?
I think they should work towards ratification. It's a good beginning in terms of where it's going to make sense to go over time. I do think that I think the new Senate deserves a chance to look at this as well.
So you see no hurry to get it done in the lame duck session of Congress.
I do not. It's of such significance that it's really one of those things that every page, every little nuance needs to be examined closely, and it's It's well worth taking a look in the new Congress.
It is an important bill, but I disagree that they need more time to vet it. This bill has broad bipartisan support and international support. So far as I can tell, the only reason that it's not coming up for a vote is it might be seen as a victory for Obama and this Congress, and the Republicans who are about to control everything don't want that signal to be sent. And so they want to delay for the sake of delay. I don't know of any strong argument against adopting this treaty. Everyone seems to agree that's a sane thing to do. It will cap the number of nuclear warheads between the United States and the Soviet Union at about 1,500, which is well more than enough to kill every single human being and living thing on the planet many times over, to destroy every city on both of the continents that these countries are on, and basically to destroy the Earth for all of time. So I think, you know, we can live with this or die with it.
This treaty and its accompanying protocols total more than nearly 400 pages. When you add all that up, it's a level of detail that's going to be very important to continue to scrutinize. And as you know, former President Reagan once said, in terms of when he was dealing with the former Soviet Union, trust but verify. And I think the verify part on this is pretty important right now, given some of the trends within Russia and how there appear to be continuing steps away from democracy in that country.
Let me a related issue is that there are a couple of Republicans, Senate Republican Whip John Kyle of Arizona and Senate Republican Steering Committee Chair Jim DeMint of South Carolina, are accusing Democrats and Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid of encroaching on Christmas and saying it's even sacrilegious that the Senate might have to work on the $1.1 trillion spending bill and this New START treaty and spend time up until and maybe through Christmas getting this work done. Your reaction to that, Bill Leaders?
Something important happened last night on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart on Comedy Central. He had on some of the first responders to 9/11 who are suffering the consequences of their heroism in terms of severe health problems that they're literally dying from. He had on four people. One of the bills that's hanging in the balance and Republican intransigence in the Senate is a bill to aid first responders to 9/11. It's not a lot of money, and the Republicans are stalling it. And one of the questions put to the firefighter who is dying from suffering health consequences, I should say, from his injuries, is was that particular quote from these senators. And he said, I don't know a single firefighter in the city of New York who considers it disrespectful to work in the fire station on Christmas Day. They're all going to be working. They're all still going to be there. And the government has no compunction about slapping them in the face when they get hurt because of their service to the country. That is a disgraceful thing to the United States of America. It's particularly disgraceful to Republicans like this who lack the courage and the decency to stand up for the people who stood up for us.
Tom Still?
Yeah, I'm not worried in the slightest that Congress might have to work into the sort of the Christmas break period. I'm not, and actually I'm not worried in the slightest that President Obama might get credit for pushing this so close to ratification, because the post-World War II track record around defense issues has been remarkably bipartisan in most respects. What does, is just making sure that the details are right, and that's the only piece here. And I think both Republicans and Democrats need to set some of this aside and make sure that is done, that the details are right.
Well, before Congress goes home for the year, whenever that might be, will the Senate pass Don't Ask, Don't Tell, a repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell? The House did this week, Bill Leaders.
Well, I heard Barney Frank on MSNBC yesterday. He was very optimistic that the Senate will pass it, and will pass it tomorrow. I think he counts the votes in support at somewhere around 63 or 64, which is, filibuster-proof majority. My concern, and I think his concern too, is that you never know where some extremist will find some way to thwart something from happening that has broad support, just to make a stand on principle, or in this case, I would say lack of principle, and just to bollock something up for the sake of asserting their own will over that of the majority of elected representatives, also the majority of the military, also the majority of the American people.
Tom Still?
I would agree with Bill that it's likely to pass. It's a bill that I think probably everyone's position has sort of been formed one way or the other. They're not likely to change how they may feel on it. And it appears that the different military branches themselves are not of one mind around it. And so if there had been some groundswell out of the various service agencies that, no, we can't do this now, and so far, that hasn't happened. So that speaks to me that it's likely to pass.
You know, there was similar opposition to other things that have happened in our country's history. When the Supreme Court ruled against interracial marriage and said that was ruled against laws prohibiting interracial marriage, the vast majority of people in the country supported those laws. When Harry Truman integrated the military racially, the vast majority of people in the military and people of the country opposed that. And yet it was done. It was the right thing to do. History has proved it to be a smart decision. This is a case where prior to the decision being made, it has achieved majority support among the American public, among members of the military, and among leadership of the military. You know, what's the holdup?
We're going to talk about the court rulings and constitutional challenges to the individual mandate in the health care law, the new health care reform law, in just a moment. But I'm way past break time, so let me remind you, you are listening to The Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine, along with Tom Still and Bill Leaders, and we welcome your comments on the news of the week. If you want to talk about health care or other issues that are on your mind right now, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's time for the Week in Review quiz. I will present one question that you can answer if you'd like to call in and guess anyway, and we will pick a winner from all of the correct answers. A pretty straightforward question today. This week, Yale University came out with its best quotes list for 2010. There was a tie for the top spot. Give us one of the two quotes deemed the best of the year for 2010, and you will win a prize, or you may win a prize, a book from our program this week, including The Essence of Happiness, a guidebook for living, which was written by our guest, along with the Dalai Lama. So that's one of your choices. If you know or want to guess which of the many different quotes throughout the year made it to the list of the top ones, the top two, it was a tie. So give us one of those two quotes. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. We're going to give you just 5 minutes or so to call in your answers or email your answers. We'll announce the winner at the end of the program, and good luck. All right, let's talk more with Tom Still and Bill Leaders about the news of the week. This week, a Virginia judge ruled against the individual mandate requiring people to purchase health care. The next legal challenge is going on now in Florida. A hearing was held yesterday, 20 states involved in that multi-state legal action. Tom Still, what do you think? Where do you think this is going?
Well, I think you could have seen the ruling itself coming from a mile away. That I think on its face, the Commerce Clause was pretty clear in terms of what the judge said about not forcing consumers to make or not make a purchase. That just seems like that was a given from a constitutional point of view. Now, where does it lead? Obviously, the whole core of the health care bill was the notion that that if people are required to pay some kind of minimum amount, it gets everybody into a system and helps even out all of the various disparities that are out there. you know, it remains to be seen whether that approach is going to prevail over time, because a lot of other things are, it seems like a lot of options are out there right now for reexamining the reform bill itself and trying to move ahead on a new basis.
What do you think, Bill?
Well, there are some 24 legal challenges to the health care law. There have been 3 that have been decided on the merits. In 2 cases, federal judges have upheld the provision that requires people to either have insurance or to pay toward it so that they are covered. And this judge, appointed by George Bush, saw it differently. I think that was a surprise to some people who thought that this was a weak argument constitutionally. And they're surprised that it prevailed. It probably does underscore that there is always the possibility that when this comes before the U.S. Supreme Court, as it ultimately will, that the crazy people who now control that court will side with the conservative argument that you can't have this health care reform. If the provision that requires people to either have insurance or to pay toward it is struck down, it will certainly also result in the destruction of the part of the health care package that prevents insurance companies from discriminating on the basis of pre-existing conditions. That will also fall by the wayside. And I think people need to remember that right now, those of us with insurance are paying, I believe the argument is, about $1,000 a year for those who have it. So we're carrying them on our backs. We're paying for their irresponsibility or the fact that they can't get insurance. And this just would remove that problem. It would make it fairer for all of us.
I think the ruling, it puts us back in an arena where it ought to be, which is the legislative debate. And again, as you know, President Obama, the new Congress, look ahead to how to continue working on what is truly a vital issue for America because of competitiveness, if nothing else, in terms of what this does in making our economy less competitive than others. I think that's going to be really important. Will there be an enduring national approach to this, or will there be state-by-state models, which have begun to emerge in some places? So I think that debate's going to recenter around that legislative approach.
Where do you see the issue going in the new Congress, Bill Leaders?
I think there'll be more antipathy toward the health care reforms. There will be attempts to repeal parts of them. This is a judicial an effort to achieve the destruction of a key component of the health care reform through judicial fiat, but there will be legislative attempts to chip away at it as well. And, you know, we need to remember that this idea of charging people who don't have insurance for the fact that they will now be covered is a Republican idea. It's what Mitt Romney did in Massachusetts. It was supported by Republicans, importantly, at different stages of the process. It is only now public enemy number one in the minds of Republicans because it was part of Obama's package and they want to hurt him politically and elect more Republicans. And one way to hurt him politically is to make health care a failure and to continue the hurt on the American people when it comes to health care delivery.
And I think that gets back to my point, and Bill's right, that this was, you know, a part of Mitt Romney's plan in Massachusetts, but that's where Massachusetts, their governor, their legislature decided that was, and I think in this case, their consumers and their business sectors decided that approach worked in Massachusetts.
Yeah, but look at the danger of doing that. In Arizona right now, we have a governor who has decided that they just can't afford to pay for transplants anymore. And so they've effectively created a death panel where people who used to have transplants are now being denied and told they just need to die and get it over with. The government is basically saying, we have money for lots of things, but not for you. Die already.
Real quick,
do we want that? Do we want states really to be able to do that?
Do you want states to be able to do that, Tom?
I think a disproportionate amount of spending on health care is in the last days of life. And I think study after study has shown that. If we can go to a more rational system where there's more in prevention, more in the childhood side I think it's going to make more sense.
We need to move on because we're almost out of time. Very, very, very briefly, a study released this week shows that air quality tested in Wisconsin bars and restaurants has improved 92% since the smoking ban went into place. No big surprise there, Bill Leaders. Do you think that smoking ban is going to stay in place?
Well, I hope it stays in place. No, I wasn't surprised that taking smoking out of bars made the air more healthy. I think if we wanted to improve food safety, for instance, maybe we ought to pass a rule that we include a little less poison. You know, things like that. They seem counterintuitive, but they might actually work. No, I'm glad that there is substantiation for what everyone knew would happen, which is that the working environment and the environment, breathing environment of our public of restaurants and bars has gotten better.
There was some talk during the campaign. Governor-elect Scott Walker said that if he was sent a bill to repeal the smoking ban, he would sign it. There's no movement to do that, is there, Tom Still?
You know, at this point, it's hard to imagine it. You know, and I think what's also happening is that a lot of, you know, in Wisconsin, you seem to see a lot of bar-restaurant combos. I think those combos are realizing, hey, it is less smoky. It is better overall for our patrons, and there are some lower costs associated with that. So I think some of those that have made the switch are discovering they kind of like it.
How about Time naming Mark Zuckerberg, the founder of Facebook, the person of the year? Quick react to that, Tom Still.
Well, the Facebook story is truly incredible. It has redefined a lot about how we communicate in this age. It's amazing. With a course I teach here at the university in terms of, you know, just knowing how the students communicate with one another and among themselves, it is foundational of the change that's undergone itself in around social media. And social media has become an enormous business tool as well. So it's really part of, again, getting back to economic competitiveness, I think, you know, it's a justifiable selection in my mind.
Do you think so?
Yeah, I think so, too. I mean, just because of the success of Facebook, the fact that the social network movie is out this year. And, you know, Facebook is not nerve gas. It's not some obnoxious, destructive thing. But I would dispute one of the claims that was made about Zuckerberg by Time magazine, which is that he has changed how we all live our lives. That's bull. He hasn't changed how I live my lives. I'm not on Facebook. I don't intend to be on Facebook. You know, I certainly can live without it.
It's time to reveal the answer to the Week in Review quiz. We asked, Yale University came out with its best quote list for 2010. It was a tie for the top spot. Here are the top two, according to Yale University. Let's take a listen.
I'm not a witch. I'm nothing you've heard. I'm you.
All right. That was Delaware Senate candidate Christine O'Donnell, who famously did that ad saying, I am not a witch. And here is, it was tied with this quote for the top quote of the year.
We're sorry for the massive disruption it's caused to their lives. And, you know, there's no one who wants this thing over more than I do. You know, I'd like my life back.
And that, of course, was a BP or former BP CEO Tony Hayward saying, "I'd like my life back after the oil spill."
Yeah, he got it too.
He's in Siberia now or something. In any case, Barb was the winner. So Barb in Grunewald, I think. Thanks very much for playing along, everybody. She will win one of the books we featured on the program this week. By the way, that list was put together by Yale librarian Fred Shapiro. He did have a couple of other quotes that we thought were kind of funny on that list. Number three was, if you touch my junk, I'm going to have you arrested, by that airline passenger who didn't like the new TSA screening procedures. Number seven was House Speaker Nancy Nancy Pelosi saying, we have to pass the health care bill so you can find out what is in it.
I think bill leaders wanted to add Marty Beal to the
list. Oh, yeah, maybe. We might have to start our own. I wish we had time to get your nominations, Tom and Bill, but we don't. Yeah. We will, by the way, be talking with Fred Shapiro from Yale University a week from Monday, so we will look forward to that. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.